Masters recorded. He was matter-of-fact as if his theory was gospel. Masters had written that this tight cluster of the boilers was the hypocenter of where the ship broke up 12,000 feet above. He thought the rest of the boilers were still somewhere in the bow section. But Jade was now aware there were other theories as well. "Release the bots," Masters commanded. With the bots they would be able to get a real interior view. Nemo and Nautilus bot doors opened as they hovered over Titanic. "Neptune released," said Flynn. "We got eyes." "Easy as you go," said Masters. Sinbad and Neptune met up. Masters watched as they disappeared into Titanic. Sinbad moved on, its lights leading into the stern. Neptune followed. Mac watched the bot go inside the deep dark passageways like a knife right down the throat. A large V-shaped section of the ship just aft of midships, running from the keel upwards, through number one boiler room and upwards to the cover area under the third and fourth funnels, seems to have disintegrated entirely when the ship broke up, said Masters. Disintegrated? They look like they were blown to bits, thought Jade. She couldn't believe the way he worded it. Also matter of fact. But all too quickly she was distracted by Flynn. "There should be a way to steerage here. Third class is this way. Follow along here, this hallway." "Yeah, keep right, there should be a stairwell. We can shoot down and get to the cargo hold," came Flynn on the radio. "There. Stop," Flynn spotted something. "There should be an entrance. That should lead downstairs." He needed to watch the screen to maneuver. Driving a bot was like a video game, his body naturally flowed as if he was at the wheel making the turns. Where? Masters looked, but could not see yet was Sinbad. "Just left," said Flynn's scratchy voice over the radio. Masters was enchanted as he drove Sinbad about. "Beautiful. Go down under the rusticles. See if she'll let us on in." Masters had waited for this moment. It seemed strange to be living the dream he had envisioned for so long. It had been 3 long years of hard work to get a camera that could take this beating. The pressure was horrific. Sinbad had many predecessors on the assembly line before her. Each bot had been individually made. The specific calculations of deep water pressure and cold temperatures added, with condensation on the lens, had all been tried and many failures had been costly. Either they imploded, or froze up, or were susceptible to leaky lens syndrome. It had stressed Masters, leaving him worn thin. There was no precious sympathy for a bot, only freezing, testing pressure that could give the end to it in a moment. So, if Masters reveled in the moment, it was his to do. He was like a kid running a remote toy boat on a lake on a sunny day. A very high-tech toy? It was easy to film him. He was interesting and brought the wreck to life the way no other could. It would be a great tour and he was the perfect guide. He held the controls. Sinbad was perfect, able to zoom in and get these striking crystal clear images, the images that would make the virtual tour idea state of the art. People would pay, and pay a lot. But, as Sinbad moved down, Master's great moment was taken away. He had no words to express the sight before him. In front of Sinbad's light was a locked and rusted gate to steerage. "Damn, it's shut and got a padlock." Shit. Third class was locked in, Flynn realized. "I can't believe it." Masters seemed human and real for once. If anything would have brought it out of him, this was it. "That means they never let them out," said Johns. "That's why there were so few third-class survivors. Can you see that? Hundreds locked below decks when she sank. Flynn too was taken aback. Jade filmed the reaction. Fucking murder. Mac filmed Flynn and Danny and he panned over. There were no words. This was something she hadn't expected. It raced through her mind. The faces of the Irish locked below, their hands clasped to the gate, pushing at it to break it open. The babies, the children, the screams, the mother's cries, the father's sorrow. They knew the sure fate of their families. They would never see New York. They would never walk the streets of America and fulfill the dream they had made this great voyage to pursue. She envisioned the horror as they died in their cabins or as the water filled the stairwell at the locked gate. Jade could hear their cries, their screams, and their drowning voices yelling, before it all went so dead silent. It would all end as the air in their lungs was besieged by salty seawater just at freezing temperature. How could life be so cruel? They might have seen the lifeboats as they caught a glimpse of them through the portholes, as they rowed away, leaving them there. Many went back to their rooms and sang a soft last prayer to the little ones before the big and final sleep. Some died sinking to the sandy bottom. Some must have floated to the surface as she broke, the explosion drawing them up, the reason they were found on the surface. Jade wanted to cover her ears as the sound of these exiled to the deep sea called. It was all too terrible a discovery. Not many had been found on sea and taken to Nova Scotia, photographed and buried, their lifeless image captured for the purposes of identification by the families. The dark staircase locked them in, the sea drowning them before they could find an exit. They were left here forever. Until now, none had known their fate. Jade was saddened beyond belief. They were locked in because there were not enough lifeboats, she thought. In this still moment, she could hardly film the horror that her heart felt, what these people must have felt. Masters was shocked too. It was one thing to have the ship go down, but this was unbelievable. These many had been taken by the sea to their graves with Titanic as their ghostly home. They now could walk where they pleased on Titanic. They now had all privileges. They owned the superstructure, the ship of dreams that was their last earthly nightmare. And now Jade would be the first to tell his story, if the words would only come. This tragic end of the third class would be the voice of the ship itself. They could not have seen the last of the night sky filled with stars before them. There was no equality for them, even in death. And so Jade kept it in her heart what she would capture in her footage. It rang so hard in her head. It must be told. It would never let go of her. It was the third class that held the most passengers that she knew. It was the steerage that brought in the money on these liners. They were the worth of their ticket. Jade could visualize it all now. This trip was cold in a way she had never felt. Maybe Masters was hardened to it, but not Jade. She would never know just how he felt, but she knew she could never forget this moment. It was real. Real people, all heading to that fate. What a damned hard fate, she thought. Masters drove Sinbad on. His mind was wrecked at the thought. It hit him hard. He didn't expect to see that either. He held a hard, unreadable face, but underneath he had ice running through his veins. This was the most horrific thing he had ever faced in any of his dives, the most horrific thing he had ever faced, period. He hadn't really thought about third-class passengers as people. He wondered how many of them ever made it to the deck. He knew that over half that had died were the third class. It didn't sound like a lot of the Irish made it out of the bowels of Titanic. If they were lucky enough to find some other way out, there were still no boats. He asked Dudley. Send me some numbers on the survivors, Copy. What numbers? Copy, asked Dudley. How many third class? Asters hesitated, you know. How many third class made it up to the lifeboats? He thought Jade should put this in the documentary, even if it was shocking, it was part of it all. For the documentary. Let's get it on record, Asters came back. I don't know where to get those numbers, Dudley's voice came scratching through. Figure it out, Masters said. He looked at Jade as if that would make it all better, like he was trying. He knew that Titanic was 883 feet. That her boiler room was the largest ever built. He knew the hull was made of hand-pounded iron rivets with walls of steel and iron. He knew the fourth funnel was for show and was only an air vent. He knew she had the largest ever built leaded glass ceiling on a vessel. She was the first to have a swimming pool. Masters knew more about Titanic than anyone, but it mattered little now. All the facts that Masters knew, he didn't know the dead. All were silent as Sinbad set forth. Nemo let out more cable for her to go into the boilers section. The little robot was almost family. It had brought Titanic so close. Masters broke the silence. Bring Neptune around and light from the side, copy. Bring Sinbad around and light from the side. Over, ordered Masters. Roger. Bringing her around. Come on, little buddy, said Flynn. The backlighting served Masters well. He would not need the flash, which would reflect back when filming and add glare and hotspots. It was all worth it to pay attention to detail on the lighting, for it showed in stunning detail in the artistry of the leaded glass window that was so well preserved in this frigid water. The windows and door have held up. The glass is still intact. Every pane is in place. Look at the intricate design. This costs some bucks, said Mac. They moved further along, through the dark and ominous ship as the shadows cast ghostly figures and strange shapes all out of place. Sinbad bumped into a rustic wall and it turned to powder smoke as Neptune came through its path. Sinbad's light caught a brass plaque on a door. What's that say? Asked Flynn. It was rusted and hard to read, so they shone the light across it. Crew members only, said Johns. Hey, look, there is a water fountain at the top of the stairs, said Flynn. What a kind gesture Andrews did for the crew to make sure they had a cool drink, noticed Johns. What a bunch of crap, said Flynn. They put it there so they wouldn't leave the boilers more than a minute. You might have a point, said Johns. We're coming to the spiral staircase, take Neptune on down, said Masters. Sinbad and Neptune disappeared down the dark metal stairs. Look at the stairwell, master craftsmanship. Look at the handrail, Max spoke soft. The bots went in and down through the eerie dark passageway further into the innards of Titanic, deep into the bowels of the ship and right into the depths of the engine and boiler rooms. The size was massive. The welding of the huge boiler was magnificent. Every bit of machinery looked as if it was built in its place, right there in the hull. Through the rust, some settings could still be read on the meters and various instruments as she went down that cold dark night. The brass was rusted, but still the fine craftsmanship held. It was so damn silent. But Masters could imagine the ship running at speed. What would it be like down here? Working an engine that size would be piercing loud, said Masters. You'd have to yell to hear the guy next to you, John said into Jade's camera. They all were wondering how bad it must have been for the crew. It's so damn dark, Can you imagine how dark it would be working down here? There's no portholes, no fresh air. Then the ship starts sinking, losing its power, and the lights go out. You have got to find your way in the pitch black. Trying to get through the walkways, the engine room, the turbine, the boilers, finding the watertight doors closing as you go, hearing the water gushing in as the dark creeps into your soul. His words were as if he had experienced it. He wanted Jade's camera to get these moments. She did too. The lights of Sinbad and Neptune now entered the massive boiler room. It was hard to make out the machinery, all covered in spikes of crusted iron. But it was all here. Nothing had been taken. It was all intact. It was the first time anyone had seen this since that night. Masters had to hold back the thrill of his conquest. But he had come through. He was a genius to figure out the lighting and technical delicacies that would make this all work. This was bringing Titanic into a new emotional light for him. Sinbad ventured in, exploring the boiler room. Archie Frost was in the engine room that night, Masters recounted. Thomas Andrews comes down. He says the ship doesn't have much time, and hesitates. If you stay here, you will die. Archie says, we'll stay here as long as we need to. And they kept the power running till the end. They were the heroes, the engineers. The men who kept the power going for the lights, the generator and the wireless telegraph, said Masters. Masters had written about it in his book, but being here, now, he realized the bravery of those men who held their posts and in so doing, died. He knew that there was not a single survivor from the engineering crew of Titanic. They were real heroes, every single one of them. His heart was hit by feelings he didn't want to have. Feelings he had locked out before. He couldn't lock them out anymore. Jade filmed. What would I have done? He imagined out loud. Yeah. John's words barely left his mouth. They had to stay down there to keep power to run the wireless radio, said Masters. It sunk into Jade. The bravery. The horror of knowing she was going down, and there weren't enough lifeboats. We're heading the bots on down to the keel. And then we're getting close to the cargo hold. Now we're talking. You got enough pictures. This is where the gold could be, Jones grinned. Morgan's gold is the main attraction. The purser's safe all full of jewels. Madeline Astor's jewels alone. She was loaded. And she left it all right here. There's a load of wealth we're sitting on. Jade figured it was the only chance she would get to see the propeller. You're wasting your time with the gold, Jade pushed. It's not here. What? John smirked. How could you know what Morgan would do with the gold? Come on. I know Morgan. He wouldn't have left the gold on this ship, she said. Why? Said Johns. He was more of a mastermind than that, Jade replied. You think Morgan would let that gold sink? Jade insisted. That's ridiculous, Jade, said Johns. Morgan reserved a suite on Titanic. Then he canceled his reservations, she said. Knock it off, Masters clipped. Morgan removed crates from Titanic at Cherbourg. What do you think was in them? That's when he took off the gold and canceled at the last minute. Put yourself in his shoes, she said. If I were Morgan, I'd have taken the gold off them at the last stop. Why would he do that? Asked Johns. I think he put it on his yacht or one of his other ships, she said. Dudley wouldn't spend all this money if the gold wasn't on this ship, said Johns. Jade, I am with you on a lot of this, But the gold, no, no, no. It seems a workable answer, the gold would still be here. It makes sense. Morgan would be carrying the gold and we can find it. Why do you need it to make sense? None of it makes sense. Don't you think it a bit strange how Titanic didn't capsize like the Britannic, her own sister ship, or the Lusitania? They went down in minutes, yet Titanic sank slowly and evenly for over 2.5 hours. That doesn't make sense. Let's make this trip a little more interesting. Why don't you just let me get a few shots of the propeller, the stamp number, the plate numbers on the propellers? She asked. Maybe there's an answer here. You're fired. Master's face went hollow. He thought, if she puts this information out there, it could end the expedition. Dudley is here for the gold. If he thought it was a farce, he wouldn't have put up the money. Although he liked to think he was in charge, he knew Dudley was the money and the real power behind the project. Okay, so that didn't work, she thought. Why had she done that? She could have kept her mouth shut. He was never going to let her film the propellers, but at least she tried. Jade realized she would never get down again to answer all her questions. Inside, she was torn up, more angry with herself than Masters. In all, she just screwed up her chance to film. Chapter 43. New York, Morgan's Yacht, 1912. Morgan stood by the bow of his yacht as he snugged down his cap. His dark jacket and white trousers gave him a seafaring look. The men who were called for the meeting were waiting on him inside. He had made them wait, the longer the better, the more in a rush they would be to hurry and accept whatever fate he dished out. He turned from the bow in the sunshine and made his way toward the study. Andrews could not help but notice the long stare in Morgan's eyes. As he entered, all eyes fell on him. He came and directly went for his cigars, lighting one as his eyes swept over them. Agitated over the long wait, Lord Pierre could no longer hold his thoughts. This is preposterous. I hear you are again insistent to run Olympic. You want the impossible, Ismay added. She'll never go to sea again, said Andrews, risking the further wrath of Morgan. There is a way around this, Morgan said. Even as he spoke, he knew the answer in his mind. He saw it there, 3 moves ahead of the rest of them. Like a chess game, he had examined the possible escape routes out of this terrible dilemma into which he had been thrust, and he had a plan. The others in the room looked around at each other blankly. Not daring to speak at this point and not really understanding where Morgan's devious mind was heading, they took the safe course and waited for him to enlighten them himself. Olympic will go back to sea one more time, Morgan was firm. One more time, Mr. Morgan? Asked Andrews. Olympic shall be patched up not for 2 years, or 6 months, or even 2 weeks, but just for one last voyage, he answered. One voyage, replied Lord Pierre. His mind was not good at working in overdrive and he could not really contemplate what a ruthless man like Morgan could possibly be plotting. Southampton to New York, Morgan hammered. A transatlantic voyage? Andrews questioned. Yes. A last run to New York, said Morgan. You'd be lucky to get her to from Belfast to Southampton, replied Lord Pierre. She's not running at all and you want to put more money into her? Said Ismay. Why would you spend any sum just to take Olympic to New York? Asked Lord Pierre. Morgan ignored the question. Who would get on that ship? Said Jack. Just get her seaworthy enough for the journey, Morgan went on. Make her look spiffy on the outside, but just enough on the inside to do the one last jaunt. She may look beautiful, but running is another thing entirely, said Andrews. She should be taken out and sunk. I don't see us spending another dime on her, Ismay put in. Damn right, Ismay. That is the idea, Morgan engaged. She's on a voyage to New York, out to the deepest part of the ocean. Then, suddenly, she hits an iceberg and sinks, he said. Andrews was certain this would never work. They would simply refuse to pay the insurance, Andrews said. You have tried that. The insurance company has denied Olympic. They know she's been in three accidents, none of which have resulted in a successful claim, Ismay agreed. Given Olympic's previous track record, there would be no insurance. But if it's not Olympic, then there would be no insurance problem, Morgan skimmed. You put them in the dock, side by side. They're almost identical ships. Over the next months you make them so. The gentlemen were listening, intent. Never before had they heard such a scam. Side by side. Titanic becomes Olympic, and Olympic becomes Titanic. We pull a switch, Morgan, thrilled with this idea, pushed his blueprints at Andrews. It's unthinkable, said Andrews, unable to contain his feelings any longer. Highly illegal. He was outraged. A switch, Mr. Morgan, said Captain Smith. It's brilliant, replied Lord Pierre. No one would question the White Star Line, said Ismay. No one would even think it, not the workers, not even the officers. Jobs are too scarce. There are mouths to be fed, Smith petted his beard. He too finally saw a way back into Morgan's good grace. I won't have anything to do with it, held Andrews. You damn well will, Morgan smoothly said. Morgan's gruff stare came back, his eyes glaring as he spoke. He didn't need to yell. He had power. They are in the dock, side by side. Pull a switch. His eyes scanned the room, defiant, daring anyone to contradict him. He threatened them all with his frightening look and that intimidating stare. There was a heavy silence that filled the room. No one could stop the horrific plan. It's brilliant, Ismay said. He wanted to get paid. If you brace the keel, prop up the shaft, replace the propeller and I don't push her, I will get you one last run out of her, came Smith, assured. How do you explain the vibration? Said Andrews. I shall claim kinks in her new engine and so on, once we're underway. What the hell? Once underway it's too late to complain, said Morgan. What will the workers think? Said Andrews as he was cut off. Only that they are doing repairs to make Olympic fit the White Star Line new orders. The switch comes at the last minute with a small crew. Morgan was in his best form. I think it's the only smart thing to do. Very clever indeed, said Ismay. If we stop work on Titanic and put all effort to Olympic, we can pull off a switch. The old man saw the plan in his head. All at once it seemed perfect, as if was meant to be. He was too eager to see it the way he had, on the blueprints of the two ships. Now it all made sense to Jack. The insurance would be attainable, Ismay's greed won over his good sense. We put her to sea as Titanic, he said, as if the deed was done. But the thought of completion crossed his mind. The awful truth of that had not been answered. His one way out would be to force Morgan to answer that question. And so he risked letting the words work their way from his mind, to his throat, to his lips and out the path that would carry them to Morgan. But you still have to sink her, said Ismay. The switch was easy, but now the reality of sinking her. A plan was needed, a plan that could stand the test of time. Ismay's face went blank, as did Andrew's, Smith's and Jack's. Andrew's could not agree with this switch. This was all too much to have happening. He was pulled into such a mad scam. He was pensive, restrained. This was all real. He was not drunk on the smoky scotch fumes that filled the room. It had come from Morgan's own lips. He heard it, a scheme with an outcome that could only mean horror. There were laws. He didn't want to face a British inquiry. Isn't Morgan thinking about that? Was he not worried about inquiries? What was Morgan thinking? He wondered. Should I reveal the deadly plan? How can I get out of this mess? So many thoughts came to him in the flash of a moment. He would want to think about it a lot longer, away from these connivers. Would they make some wild plan that he would have to agree to? He thought. I must stay. It is better to stay and see what their decisions are. But he had already seen in their eyes a determination to get their money. It was for sure that if they didn't do the switch, the White Star Line would go bankrupt. Andrews had his morals, but at the end of the day he needed work and was lucky to have this prestigious appointment. Work was not easy to come by, that was for sure. And he had become accustomed to the lifestyle. Sink the ship? How could it might be done? Captain Smith said nervously. His thoughts were running fast with all kinds of visions. If it was an accident, a crew would be needed. A small crew, that was certain to be trusted, would have to be acquired. I won't do it if lives are lost. I don't want to be part of anything so terrible, said Smith. But he thought, Morgan calls the shots. Why doesn't he just say something? Why does he just stare at the blueprints? What the hell am I getting myself into? Should I disagree with him? If I should do that, Morgan will plaster my record in every paper. He'd see it etched on my gravestone if I don't comply, that he would. So should I bow to him, my lips sealed? Smith was a wreck thinking all this. It was more than his brain could bear. He was a simple man when it really came down to it. This was like a horrible chess game and he couldn't see the next move in a game he didn't want to play. How could he get out of it? Was there not some escape hatch? On the sea, there were always risks, but he was being forced into a most volatile situation where he saw no gracious outcome. In the middle was Jack. He felt caught between his needs and his morals. It came down to that. He could walk away. Yes. Surely he could. He was against this dubious plan, but he was behind the old man's play. This was his inheritance. Morgan was 74 years old and he would not live forever. Then Jack would command everything. There would be no everything if White Star went bankrupt. Jack looked at his father, wondering what he had meant by sinker. He was privy to most plans, but this was bothering him deep into his soul. Without answers, he felt vulnerable, like a rook on his father's chessboard. Jack was not happy with many of the deals the old man had been involved in. He thought Morgan had overpaid for everything, and the White Star Line was proof. Morgan was in so deep. The White Star Line would go bankrupt if secret measures, highly illegal measures, were not taken. It was such that the cells in Morgan's brain swirled around all the answers, and came up with a decision. Jack had seen it before. Morgan could see he had them. The thought of them not agreeing had not wrinkled his brow. No one was bowing out. They all somberly listened to the stone silence as Morgan easily saw their thoughts. What was in it for them? Was the brutal truth. He knew he could bend them to his wish as easily as the words left his mouth and turned into molecules that collected in space and went into their waiting ears. They were there to serve him, and serve him they would. It would be up to them to keep the secret, so devilishly laid there today. They would all be accomplices in whatever plan was set forth. It was set in motion now, whatever outcome he determined. Had he not had to face similar problems in his banking endeavors? Morgan knew money talked. It drew his thoughts back to how he had laid the plan to set the banking system on end. It was a brilliant plan, put out rumors and false stories in the papers to get the public frightened that the banks were unstable and insolvent. Then a panic would ensue. He would step in and buy up all the faltering banks and pick up their assets, their real holdings. It was about control. Even the president had come to Morgan and asked him to help stop the panic of 1907. Morgan used that to his advantage. President Roosevelt himself was coerced into letting Morgan have access to the banking records. After that, he knew what each bank was holding. It was like reading your opponent's cards at poker. He knew what bets to make. So in a bind was the country after the crash began, that the people were now losing their savings. They were clamoring for the government to intervene. Morgan had cleaned up on the panic. Perhaps this is where he appropriated the money to buy the White Star Line. He would never tell. President Roosevelt was enticed to remove strict legislation that would allow him to break the Antitrust Act. As a financier, Morgan knew his way around money better than anyone. As a master of money, he felt above the law. All those years on his yacht etched that in his mind. There was no law on the sea. He became a pirate, a different kind of pirate. He loved every minute of it. He could live as decadently as he wished. Here on the sea, away from the eyes of his wife, he could do as he pleased. The new century fitted him and his new ideas for the economy, and these ventures would pay off big. This was the age when all kinds of inventions, technology and travel were all coming to new levels. Morgan wanted his money and power to rise with it. He wanted to be on the cutting edge of it all. He had invested in these ventures. Owning the shipping line was one of the things he saw as crucial. War or peace, people were moving and traveling. America was prosperous. People were coming here, making money and then vacationing back home or bringing over the rest of the family on the transatlantic voyage. At $35 a head in steerage and with millions coming every year, it was a great investment. Goods and services were more easily made now, and shipped across the sea. The ships were valuable, there was no other way to transport. And if you made it a luxurious adventure, a sure fortune was to be made from the rich taking passage, and the name of the White Star Line would be known around the world. It was a voyage everyone would brag of, and there was no better way to travel. Morgan knew that. He had built for himself the largest yacht ever designed to date. The private yacht accomplished much for him. He was able to do all his business, yet be in perpetual freedom at the same time. He held most of his meetings on his yacht, preferring to have the meetings come to him. He was his own version of a traveling businessman. He brought new meaning to the word luxury. And at this time of his life he wanted to drink, party, and secure his deals away from the boundaries of countries' rules and laws. International rules of ownership were something he intended to change. He wanted to make money from money. This was on his mind more than anything. It all seemed attainable as he cruised the seas in his mighty, yet sleek, yacht. The world was at his feet, if he would just not step on it so hard. He was born rich, but unlike his father he learned the way of using other people's money. It had served him well, In his international travels, he had met foreign bankers and heads of state, who profited from his advice. He had connections in the financial world where he learned how money and banking around Europe was handled. It was different in the United States, where the laws had held against central banking after President Jackson was so persistent in exposing central banking for what it was. It was what Jackson's campaign was built upon, and it won him the presidency. The country had prospered and without national debt. The country and its people had real money and value in their land and business, without interest accruing to money printed by the government. But that was then, and Morgan had different ideas, and Jackson was long gone. Morgan sought men who could further his desires and strategies for the future. He was cautious of men who held to Jackson's ways. Men like Astor, Lindbergh, and Strauss were in the way. It was time for new structure, to go along with the new technology of the times. He whined, dined, and enticed all that had connections and power to help him with his plans. Money bought people. Women worked well too. Being invited into the Morgan circle was prestigious. It made the gossip columns of the day. Everyone wanted to be in the columns at that time. This was where the elite would show off their lifestyles. Who was to marry which millionaire? Or whose dog was entering which dog show? What horse had won a blue ribbon race and who owned it? Who sailed to Europe for the lovely months of the year or frequented the Spartex in France? It was all there in the columns. Morgan's ships could be at the head of it all, attracting all the classes, first class, second class, and steerage. His ships would be the largest ever built at the time. It was such ventures that brought him to the attention of the British government, which made the decision to have Morgan handle its gold, for safekeeping, for they knew the war would be coming. They had already made restrictions that any Cunard Lines vessels or White Star Lines could be outfitted for war. They would be fitted with guns and cannons in an easy attachment on the big decks. Morgan agreed to that. He had to get them to allow an international company like Morgan's International Mercantile Marine Company to buy White Star Line. Morgan hoped to dominate transatlantic shipping through interlocking directorates and contractual arrangements with the railroads. It was all part of the politics of big business. He knew he would make money, especially in the war. Moving the gold for the British was an exceptional deal that he had worked on. The gold needed to be moved to a safe country. This was exactly the kind of business deal Morgan could handle. He had the ships. He was a banker. He could make them interest on investments and ensure safety. The British government would ensure the gold and Morgan would transport it. This was where Morgan wanted to focus. The war would hit. Men in the know were moving assets around. This was how fortunes were made or lost, so Morgan needed the trivial matters of RMS Olympic behind him. This all would soon be over. This petty problem about RMS Olympic and claiming insurance was but a nuisance to him. At least, he wanted it behind him swiftly. He would sink the ship, claim the insurance, and keep the White Star Line prosperous. All the details would be taken care of. These men in the room would agree, and so a plan would be put into action. Take the propeller from Titanic to get Olympic running, switch the ships and sink Olympic as Titanic. Morgan's words struck like a knife in the cold and blood this corps of men, bending before him, to his will. He oversaw the blueprints and the simple changes needed to make the final switch. "You do this? Make a switch in such a way?" Jack questioned his father's morals as he whispered. "They're practically identical," Morgan missed the disheartened tone his son put forth. He answered as if he had Jack's approval. "The workers will be told they are making the changes as part of the fleet orders for changes to make them identical. There is nothing out of place in refurbishing Olympic to meet these slight specifications. Call them improvements. Why would they question that? They want work and they'll be glad of it, Morgan so comfortably said. People already get them mixed up. When we're at the end, the workers will be released. They won't have to come back to the shipyard. A small, trusted, well-paid crew comes aboard on the weekend to do the changes, the lifeboat names, the menus, the nameplates. When the crew arrives, they will go to Olymp or Titanic and take her on her maiden voyage, Morgan said it as if it had already taken place. Their collective heads agreed. They knew he was not bluffing and that if they did not agree to fall in with his plans, he would not hesitate to carry out his threats. Without a moment's regret, too, they would be out of work. Peary and Andrews looked crestfallen, defeated, but they realized that they had no choice but to succumb to Morgan's dastardly scheme, and what was more, if they could somehow manage to pull it off, it would indeed not only save their respective companies, but their own skins too. They turned their full attention to the fix. So then, he said, finally looking around, that's settled. He was done with them. He wanted his mistress. We have 3 weeks now until Olympics, Titanic sea trials, gentlemen. You have a lot of work to do before then. Chapter 44. Atlantic Siren, 1993. Jade was lying in the sun, as she'd been fired. She read there, quietly. The dive had been called off that day as the equipment needed a double check and Nemo had been hoisted up to do a complete check. Dudley was looking over the blueprints on the table, not too close but enough so that their voices were in range. What about getting into the cargo hold? Asked Dudley. You're on the bow run, the gold could be in there. There's little damage, from the looks of it. Once we locate the safe or cache of gold, we cut a hole in the side and pull it out. What's the plan for this? I want to see it. Astor's heart stopped at the thought of cutting into her. His brain shut off and he could only feel hate and anger. Dudley was talking but he couldn't hear. He saw them, in his mind, cutting into the hull. He couldn't see past it. Dudley's words echoed. Cut into her? And Dudley was serious. After all, this had been the plan. It raced through Master's mind, boiling his blood and sending his pressure up, and there was no valve to let off his steam. Titanic's bow was her best preserved section. It still held the majesty of greatness, a sample of the era resting alone, below, so deep. Sure, she was covered in rust and barnacles, but under that were her nameplate and the white star line pride that she carried. Masters was thrilled the boat was remarkably intact. The portholes were still undamaged, full of their original glass plates. The front decking was still lined in the wood planks. The removable railing on the bow was still in one piece. Below deck were the crew quarters. And below that was a third-class steerage section, and directly below that was the cargo hold. William Carter's car was on the cargo list. The gold could be in that same cargo hold. From the looks of the hull, it should be easy to get to, said Dudley. Nothing is easy to get to, Dudley, said Flynn. Do you think it survived? Danny asked. We're not interested in the car, son, said Dudley. Did Carter survive? Asked Billy. Masters wondered. He was a first-class passenger. Masters realized how little he knew about the things that mattered, the passengers. From Masters' photos he could see that until you got to the area under the bridge she was in excellent condition, frame-wise. In her day, Titanic touted exclusive sections located on the bow of the A deck. And there were the jewel, the grand staircase, with its elaborate domed ceiling, and the first-class cabins, the first-class reading and writing room, three elevators, and lavatories. Only some of the richest people in the world at the time had ever seen the luxurious accommodations. Cabins for all of the first class had large staterooms, the C-class equivalent to suites in the penthouse of a luxury hotel. Staterooms outfitted for royalty were exquisitely designed in neoclassical styles, with Dutch doors that connected to adjoining rooms fitted with a vanity table and even a lavatory sink. A fine brass bed and a sofa berth for an extra passenger, a heater and closet, were all surrounded by hardwood, brass fixtures and all-around comforts. Leaded, stained glass doors opened out to a private deck. The steel frame itself had held up surprisingly well, except for whatever caused the thrashing that ripped her in two. The intricate workmanship Masters had observed was still proving its quality beyond doubt, even in the harsh conditions. All this talk about rivets not being heated enough as they were pounded in was bunk, he thought. The rivets were, although hard to see under the rusticles, all seemed to have held up over all this time. That didn't seem to be the problem, nor did the steel being weak, as another theory had proclaimed. No, it was the big jutting gash that had torn Titanic in two that raised the questions. But that wouldn't stop Dudley. He just saw gold and figured once they had the photos Dudley would tear into her. And with the law prohibiting exploiting Titanic, who the hell would see her? What the hell did it matter if she was now torn for her treasures? He thought. The wheelhouse was already torn off in the initial force of sinking and the captain's room near to that. She'll all too soon see the hand of pirates, sitting right here, he thought. This is what he had dreaded all along. Dudley was here with the equipment available to do it. Master's photo mosaic would only show her before Dudley did his damage. If only Master's mind would stop racing. It was minutes before he realized that he had missed every word Dudley said. Had he noticed? Did he care? He didn't know. We're working our way through as fast as we can, he said. You're putting too much time into photos, Dudley hounded Masters. Just know that once you cut into her, the structural damage is compromised. Anything is apt to happen. That's why we need the virtual tour to be complete. Who knows what will happen if we open her to get this gold, he defended. I don't want to lose a bot. We can't afford it. You're not hearing me, said Dudley. You have got hours of footage. It took forever to build. I spent 3 years on these bots. It can take a second of bad judgment to lose one, Masters kept firm. You have no idea what's down there. You're not taking the risk. That's me down there in that sardine can. We're losing time here, argued Dudley. You better hope I don't quit, said Masters. Easy now. We're on the same boat here, said Dudley. He didn't want to lose this seasoned hunter, this gearhead extraordinaire, unless he had to. The purser's safe should be locatable unless it has fallen through the floors then, we're guessing. Then we hit the cargo hold for Morgan's gold, said Johns. I'm planning to hit the cargo hold next run, Masters assured him. You bring up something, Dudley locked eyes with him. I'll get it done, Masters said. He left, displeased. Dudley, Johns, Flynn, Billy and Danny continued talking. Masters listened by the door, disenchanted by the loyalty of his crew. But gold does that to a man. And this was a lot of gold. He always wanted to know what the others were up to. But he couldn't hear much. He needed to know what their devious minds were thinking. It was apparent whom he could trust. The closer they got to the goal, the worse it got. All the time Dudley had spent going through the records, he was eager to cash in. But it was a secret that the British gold was being moved on Titanic, so any guess was as good as another at this point, as to where it was. Masters thought hard about going along with Jade's theory. Tell them that there was no gold. That it had been taken off in Cherbourg when Morgan took off the crates. That way they wouldn't cut into Titanic. But then they would cancel the trip and he wanted those interior shots. And someone else would get it if he didn't. He listened. We want that gold. The cargo hold, the gold and the safes are the mission, Dudley said. I won't have the rest of the trip wasted. This is high quality 99% pure bars. Maybe some in coin, said Dudley. I'll get it for you. Danny and I can bring that sweet little prize right to surface, said Johns. What is Masters waiting for? Danny asked. He's gotta be cautious to the max. He's cautious retentive, said Johns. We got the gear. We're already in the interior run. We just need to slip down to that cargo hold. Search, Flynn said. It was daunting to Jade, the play of scheming going on here 2 miles above Titanic. Chapter 45. Atlantic Siren, 1993. Jade took her papers and went to the cabin to search more. She had Mac as interested as she was. It's so hard to get the records of the changes to Olympic. Yeah. Officially, records of those changes would be ditched, said Mac. They wouldn't want them officially to exist, Jade worried. They wouldn't have been kept with the master records at Harland and Wolf. So many things are out of place. Masters knows it. That's why he fired us, he said. Follow the money, she reminded him. Mac got on her tape machine and played an interview with Mysteries of Titanic's writer, Clark Stone. They held the surviving crew at the Plymouth docks when they arrived back in England, he said. Instead of being sent straight home, which is what should have happened, they were held for 24 hours in the stamp shed in a dockyard, not allowed at or to speak with the press. They were visited by a high up in the White Star Line and a British government official. Then the traumatized crew was all photographed and intimidated, which was not normal. They were forced to sign the British Official Secrets Act and were told to keep quiet. There were some questions about the boilers being those of an already used ship. She stopped the tape. It just made her wonder why Masters had just gone along not questioning any of this. She hated him. Sometimes hate felt good, justified and easy. She was no angel, she bled like the rest. She was glad she was fired so she didn't have to deal with all the deception. It was easy to tell herself that now that she'd lost. It didn't seem to bother Mac as much. Yeah. He was pissed that they couldn't follow more of the details that were leading to a pretty interesting destination. But in some way they were both relieved they didn't have to get back in that sub. It was one of those things you had to be a gearhead to enjoy. These guys, Johns, Danny, and Masters, were born ready to explore. What other ships had they seen? Mac didn't care. He was here for Jade. They liked the safety of land and making films. He knew things were not going well between the crew, Masters and Dudley. Jade knew it too. When the whole expedition ended because of differences? Had this quest ended for Jade and Mac? They had to sit around now, useless, as the gearheads went down and finished without them. Mac knew being fired was really hitting her hard. She was really into this whole Titanic venture and had found decisive details that just didn't add up. Pieces were falling out of the woodwork. Chapter 46. Morgan's yacht, 1912. So it's all taken care of. The ships are now identical. Are you sure you want to change the names? Asked Jack. Yes. Get the engraver to fill in the name on the bow and stern over the weekend, said Morgan. It shall be done while the shipyard is virtually deserted. The nameplates and lifeboats, said Jack. They best be trustworthy, Morgan firmly stated. We are paying them £100 each.